03, 04, 04 Mini, 04 Mini High, GPT-4o, GPT-4.5. What model are you using? Chris Hay is a distinguished engineer and CTO of Customer Transformation. Chris, welcome back to the show, and what's your preferred model?
Oh, you missed 4.1, Tim. So that's going to be my model. I'm picking 4.1, the one Tim didn't pick.
Very nice. Thank you, Chris. Vioma Gajer is an AI technical solutions architect. Vioma, welcome back to the show. Your preferred model, please.
Thank you, and I think it's DOD-04.
Nice. The classics. And joining us for the very first time is John Willis, who is an author and owner of Botchagloop Technologies. John, great to have you on the show. What is your preferred model?
Hey, Tim. Gemini 2.5. Oops, sorry. I think I was 03, but I think 4.1 is actually for coding is kind of my favorite right now.
So. Nice. That's awesome. Well, all that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a world-class crew of technical experts, wisecrackers, I'm talking about you, Chris, and industry veterans to discuss and debate the biggest news in artificial intelligence. As always, there is a lot to cover. We're going to talk about Gemini being on-premises. We're going to talk about John's great blog post on AI evaluation tools. And we're going to talk about NVIDIA opening up factories for chips in the US. But first, I want to start with OpenAI announcing more models. So just this week, they announced 03 and 04 Mini, their kind of latest generation of their ongoing kind of class of models. And I guess maybe, Chris, I'll throw it to you first. On a vibe check, these seem really good. Like 03 seems amazing. I don't know if you agree with that or how you've kind of felt about it on a kind of initial pass about the models.
Yeah, no, I've been having a lot of fun with those models last night. So 03 is really good. And one of the things I really appreciate about it as well, it is actually improved the personality. It's just a lot more on it. So things like being able to kind of make really good refactoring suggestions and how to improve the architecture of your code is actually coming back with some really good stuff. I have to say 04 Mini at the moment, just for getting stuff done quickly, you know, I want to create some unit tests or I just want to refactor some code, then 04 Mini is just doing great. And it is super, super fast. So I'm impressed with the models. I'm loving it. And again, as I said at the beginning, 4.1 sitting in the kind of Codex CLI, loving that as well. So this is a great week for models.
John, it'd be good to bring you in. I mean, I think, you know, there's some grumpy people on Twitter. There always are grumpy people on Twitter from the Peanut Gallery who for these announcements were like, this is just incremental. This is not like a big deal. There's no big new features they're announcing. This is just like a slight improvement. And like where, you know, the argument was kind of, OpenAI is like asleep at the wheel just because like they're not really making the groundbreaking advancements that we're expecting. Do you buy that at all as a way of kind of thinking about this new announcement?
No, I think they're constantly advancing. I mean, you know, like I said earlier, sort of half joke, not joking at all about the 2.5 on Gemini, how powerful that is. And then we'll get to a Google section, but I went all in on the 03 Mini with deep research, and that was like, okay, this is changing my life. And then, like, literally a month later, I'm finding that, you know, the deep research at Gemini is better. I think the grumpiness, you know, I won't go on about the grumpiness and the comparisons. It's all nonsense. It's what you want to solve. I mean, for me, I'm a DevOps. You know, I'm one of the founders of the DevOps movement. I wrote the DevOps Handbook. And I think this, to me, I go to SWEbench right off the bat. The software engineering, that's the place I go first, right? And you know, I haven't verified it, but, you know, it looks like the, you know, sort of the 03, you know, the 03 and the 04 Mini like have a significant jump based on their benchmarks of the SWEbench, right? And so how do you solve like the kind of problems that I face with my customers, which is how do we solve problems? That's the ones, and you know, if I believe the benchmarks, I haven't tried them yet, but and then I think the Ada Polyglot benchmark is also another really good one to take a look at. And so those are the kind of problems I face with my people expect me to know things about AI and DevOps and infrastructure. So I try to stay up on that.
Yeah, for sure. Vioma, what was your review? I don't know, kind of if you've played around with the models yet and what you thought.
I did play around with the models a little bit. One of the things that I noticed right off the bat is it takes a longer time to reason now. So the reasoning time has increased a bit, but that has helped them like improve their accuracy. I wouldn't use the word accuracy so loosely, but it will give you some sort of relevant answers, more accuracy in getting relevant answers. So I feel that was one of the sweet things that I saw that has improved in these models. There is a lot of visual reasoning also added to it. So like if there are images, you ask it a question. And then, so I was asking it like, hey, I'm doing some planning for a particular wedding. Can you tell me how do I go about the decor? What do I do about this? And I just gave in like weird Pinterest, Pinterest images and trying to reason with them as well. So it told me, no, this doesn't work. This works. So I feel that is, I'm the first one to say this in this podcast, and it's not Chris saying it, but the agentic AI use with these particular models.
You did it. You actually beat Chris to it this episode. So.
Yes. And I think that is going to be game changing for this as well. Like, yes, all these models have like small, small improvements, but it depends how can you use these improvements in enterprise. And I feel these models have that edge over an enterprise AI.
Yeah, for sure. And I want to dig a little bit more into that. And I do love the idea that, like, my friend was like, the minute that an agent can plan a wedding, you know, like AGI is here, basically.
There you go.
Like, that's the threshold that we will need to pass.
Exactly.
So part of the announcement, OpenAI was touting kind of both of the things you're talking about, right? Like, one of them was the idea that its agentic tool use was improved. And it sounds like it is better kind of in the stuff that I've been playing around with. But I think the one thing that might be interesting, and I don't even quite understand this, so maybe kind of folks on the panel can help me kind of like parse through it, is that, you know, they said, look, one of the great things about our models now is that they literally think in images. And that's going to lead to much better performance with visual reasoning. Vim, what's that mean exactly, think in images? I don't know if you have kind of a sense of that as we kind of like parse through it. Because I read it and I was like, I don't even know what that is exactly.
Yeah. So I feel thinking in images is creating those different graphs based on the questions that you ask, or like trying to do like a side-by-side analysis. Let's say I fed in some images to reason through those images. Let's say I gave it like a screenshot of pivot table or something, and I'll be like, hey, this is what I want. This is how I wanted to reason with this particular pivot table, then help me generate a report. So to kind of understand these images, to understand the nuances of it, and then to make it relevant to the question that you ask, and then give you an answer based on those kind of visual representations that you see. So it all seems like, oh, I gave in a picture, it's so cool. But there's so much math that goes behind it that it's crazy that we've reached these levels that we can actually reason in these images and visuals that we are seeing now.
I think that, to me, that's the difference, is that the reasoning, I think, you know, I don't know exactly where the reasoning changed in the new models versus the old, but my sense is that, and you guys can correct me, is if I loaded it sort of an image in one of the prior models, I got pretty much an interpretation of that image, but now I can sort of reason. It will do the sort of the chain of thought reasoning around my question with the images, and be able to sort of task through certain image understanding, you know. So the whole idea that the whole reasoning and task oriented, I mean, that buys into the whole agentic. So I'm the second one, right? So agentic agentic processing is like, it was a little bit harder in the older models to be able to sort of, you had to sort of, not really single shot, but now it will actually take the task of like reading a file or doing a search, or, you know, sort of figuring that stuff out for you. So my sense is, not being an expert in it, that it does the same with sort of reasoning with images.
Chris, maybe I'll bring you in. I think one always kind of like benchmark that I have kind of in mind is like, you know, sort of like the kind of race between open models and closed models in the space. And, you know, I think every month it's kind of like neck and neck, right? Like open source models seem to be gaining really quickly. Then kind of like the more closed source model companies will release something really interesting. How do you read O3 and O4 Mini? Like, do you feel like, you know, Close is still staying ahead of this game? Is Open really catching up? You know, I'm kind of curious on like, just to check in on that race and whether or not this kind of causes you to update at all.
No, I don't think it's going to cause me to update. I mean, as I said, I'm a huge, huge fan of the O3 models and the O4 models. I have to say, I was really for agentic. I actually am really loving the 4.1 Mini at the moment. Just, even though it's not a reasoning model, I have to say, just for kind of coding tasks and then evoking chain of thoughts with it is actually kind of really good in that sense. But coming back to the kind of closed versus open, I'll make a prediction, and I'm fairly confident in this prediction. Today we are going to be amazed. This is, oh wow, this is the greatest thing. And then within the next month, I'm going to say DeepSeek will update with their latest model. And I think most of the gains that you will see on reasoning and 03 or 04, you will see the equivalent probably in that model. And then we'll be like, oh my goodness, open source is caught up again. There's no moat and stuff like that. And we're going to keep going through that cycle. So I just think that the time from seeing something groundbreaking from the closed models to open source catching up, there is a lag. I would love to see the day where open source, or, and I keep saying open source and the comment section is going to go wild when I really mean open weights, right? But when the open weight community, I would love to see it where they go ahead of the closed source providers. That would be a big changing mode. Whereas I think at the moment there is just a lag all of the time. It's a small lag, but there's still a lag. But I have to say, the new 03 model and the 04 one middle, it really is beautiful. I mean, the answers are good. The reasoning is good. The personality is great. I love it at the moment, actually.
Nice. It's got that je ne sais quoi, you know? So
yeah.
Yeah, and I have to say, I mean, I feel for the team at OpenAI, right? It's like that kind of like window is getting shorter and shorter and shorter, right? Where it's like you relaunch something, you're ahead, and you only have just like so much time to capitalize on that before kind of the open weights catch up. And it's tough strategically and I can come competitively for them.
But are they really catching up? And I'm all in for open weights and open source models, right? I want them to win for so many reasons, right? Beyond what we talk here. But I mean, I'm just looking at a select committee strategic competition by the government, a DeepSeek Unmasked paper that I think just came out last couple of days, right? And I mean, there's just a lot of dragons in DeepSeek. So if DeepSeek is the one that's really the poster child for open weights, again, I don't know. That worries me because I do more research than I do coding, but I do a fair amount of coding. I mean, right now the models that I use, the Sonnet, for pretty much, I'll have to try 4.1 a little bit more, but the Sonnet, and then I use Gemini 2.5 for my research, and I don't. The amount of work to do the investigation to find things right now that could work better for me, I just don't see on the horizon.
Yeah, I feel this is going to be like a ever-changing field. And as I've started seeing like in enterprise AI, I keep talking about it, but the clients are now looking into more complex use cases. So I don't feel like one model fits all solution is going to help anyway. So I feel as long as we have new models, that's fine. Like there are different use cases for each of these different models. There's going to be a market for each one of them. So we'll see as we evolve once we go into production, which I don't think have gone so bullish over for a couple of months now. So I'm hoping this is the year when we're like, oh, this is the broad environment, which is fully agentic. Like I'm yet to hear it from someone.
And I want to build on that, Vyoma, because I actually think it's less about the model. I truly think it's about the ecosystem and the tools. So if we come back to one of our earlier discussions with things like Manus, then it's being able to go, who is doing the planning in this sense, right? And that may be the large model that's doing the planning and the reasoning, but then what tools are available to that? So John, in your world, does it have access to a compiler? Does it have access to something like a Terraform? Do you have the knowledge models which explains what a good CI/CD pipeline looks like, what a good Terraform template looks like? This is the best practice for a Kubernetes cluster. So there's a whole set of knowledge that doesn't need to exist in the model itself, and there's a whole set of tools that you need to make available. Now, you need a good orchestrator, you need good context, and that's why the models become really important. But I would say that a really super all-knowing model that doesn't have access to your knowledge repository, that doesn't have access to a good ecosystem of tools, is going to not be as great as a proper agentic workflow. So I think, honestly, that's going to be the big play over the next year. So I do want to get away from talking about models, but I want to get into this ecosystem world.
And I think I just wanted to, I mean, you said it way more elegantly than I said earlier. It's like when you asked me, Tim, about this chatter on Twitter or wherever, right? Like it is about the work that you like that you said, but so that you're right. It's less about the model every other week coming out with some advance and this one's better and what did a benchmark say. In the enterprise space, it's going to be about some mixture of orchestrated models, and a lot of them will be very focused on the task at hand. Exactly. So thank you for summarizing that.
There's an announcement that we actually did not get a chance to cover last week. It was announced as part of the kind of Google Cloud Next sort of raft of announcements that came out. But I did want to make sure that we touched on it because I think it was a pretty intriguing kind of like a move, I would say, by Google in the space. And the substance of the announcement is that Google is going to let companies run Gemini models on their own data centers starting in Q3. So this is kind of the rise of like effectively like a company saying, we will allow you to do on-prem hosting of these models. And I guess, John, maybe I'll turn it to you first. This is like kind of a big deal, right? Because I think companies traditionally have been very, very paranoid about kind of letting anyone run their models on their own infrastructure. But Google clearly thinks that there's some upside here. How do you read this move?
I think, you know, they were first in on running Kubernetes on-prem. I mean, like, it's a good move. I think, you know, it shows that they're less worried about somebody reverse engineering their sort of their layers and their model, right? Like that, like, cause that is sort of like the danger, right? I mean, even though the DeepSeek was able to do it with OpenAI anyway, but yeah, no, I think I've been a big fan of Google for years. I mean, you know, if you add up all the bells and whistles running Vertex on-prem, I think the Gemini models are, you know, are there right up front with everyone else. I think, solving that air gap problem. And I think now they're making a strong argument for why you might want as an enterprise, you know, have an option to go all in on the Google structure, you know, and you got the sort of the agent space thing, which is now this workspace stuff. And you know, I've done some hackathons with the Vertex. And if you're in on the Google infrastructure, like Gmail and all that stuff, it becomes a very powerful workforce automation structure.
Yeah, I think I hadn't really thought about that, John. I guess, Chris, I don't know if you have any comments to that. Is like, how much should we think about this almost like a DeepSeek downstream thing, right? Which is normally the fear would be, oh, well, you're going to reverse engineer my models if I let you just like run it on-prem. And I guess, is this sort of a concession to the idea that like, well, reverse engineering is going to happen anyways in this space. So like, why worry about that?
I would love it if I could have Gemini to run on my machine so I can sit and reverse engineer it and figure out what they're doing and how it differs from Gemini. So yeah, please Google, please do it. I think the on-premise announcement is actually kind of super important because the reality is that if you take things like government organizations, military organizations, etc., there's a whole set of people who can't run their workload on cloud. And therefore, being able to satisfy the AI workload, I think, on-premise, from a security perspective, I think is super necessary. And I also think that when we've had these discussions about latency before, where as we move into agentic workloads, then there is going to be a need to run your AI closer to device and going to be closer to your system. So a good example is maybe if you're running a kind of a gaming environment or like a stadium or, you know, anything that's got like, you know, maybe on-premise cameras or whatever, then the need to have that data not go up into the cloud, but actually be as close as possible. I think there is a market that is definitely underserved there. And I think Google is making sense to go under that. The real difference is, to your point, is how safe and secure are they feeling that that their model weights are not going to be reverse engineered. And again, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know how good the encryption is on these kind of Blackwell chips and all that are. But I'm pretty sure that once these things are out in the open, then somebody's going to release it somewhere. And maybe they're okay with that. But I think I think it's an interesting move. And I think it's a necessary move that the industry's going to have to go towards. So, you know, well done, Google. The only thing I would say is outside of those very large organizations, and I'm just thinking about the sizes of the Gemini models, are people really going to have the GPU workloads for that? I get it from maybe the small models, right? So maybe I know they're doing kind of Gemini mini type models. I think that's a reality. But for their frontier models, are those organizations really going to have the GPUs? And even if they do, are they going to want them just sitting around, whirring away, doing nothing? I'm not so sure. So I think it's a good play. I think it's going to be interesting to see how that works out over time.
Yeah, for sure. And Vyoma, this is actually going to a direction that I would love to get your opinions on, is like almost like market size. Because it feels like the unique advantage that Google has in saying you can run this on-prem are these giant models. And it's kind of like, well, what's the set of customers that actually has like the technical proficiency to run like a big inference cluster of this scale? And you can say, okay, well, you know, maybe the market is actually in like smaller models. But then kind of the argument is like, well, isn't it open source then? Then it's just like really cheaply, just like easier to just do open source and run it on your own infrastructure anyways. And so kind of like there's a question about like how big of a market is Google really talking about here? And I don't know, to Chris's point, maybe it is just like the government and that's a huge customer. But curious about how you size that up.
Yeah, so this goes back to our previous question that we were asked, it is discussing. I feel Google is trying to do this to position itself in these slower moving industries, such as like who have been a little bit slower in adapting AI, like the government, healthcare, high litigation industries, finance, etc. So I feel they are trying to position themselves as the key leaders in those industries that, hey, now we have a model. Now you can utilize this, at least get them embarked on this entire journey of AI, which hasn't been so great yet, right? And to rebuild that trust over there. And yes, slowly, slowly, as we've seen this entire space evolve, I feel there will be smaller models that will be coming in, which will help them reduce the space, have reduced GPUs, etc. But I feel this is like a Kickstarter event that, okay, here, now there's one here. We've started this entire revolution. Like, I feel in a couple of months, or like weeks, we can't say that anymore, this gap is going to reduce significantly that between cloud and on-prem. So as it is, it was a much discussed topic everywhere. Whenever I go meet clients, their biggest problem is their data sovereignty, governance, AI. And once you bring something like this, okay, now you have this, are you going to adapt to this? If you adapt to this, we'll have 10 different problems which will come up. Someone else will try solving those 10 different models with their own smaller version of model. So I feel this is going to be evolving over a couple of months that we see. And the open source models, that part that you said with like smaller models that they go utilize it. But if it's not prem, it's not of any use for this like huge market that we have in highly litigated industry. So we'll see.
But I think the latency is a big issue. I've tried to build some voice and integrated stuff, and it's really hard to do. So latency is, but I think it goes back to scale, is what Google understands is scale. And they've been doing GDC for, I mean, five years now at scale. They're running Kubernetes, they bought Wiz. So, I mean, there's some real ingredients there. There are a lot of large manufacturing companies that are really looking for. And I've been to a couple of that like, I think this could really resonate right now in terms of like the IP that it takes to build tractors or, you know, there's just a lot of things that are just still, they're very worried about that IP living out. So not just, I mean, air gap for sure. Government, absolutely, top secret clearance, but just IP. I mean, just, you know, really important IP. And just to put a dot on it from a DevOps folk, like people talk about open source, but like, okay, I'm going to go open source model. I'm going to open source, which Kubernetes am I going to use? It starts adding up. The cost of managing that stuff becomes its own little cottage industry in an organization. So to me, it seems like a very appealing opportunity.
I'm going to move us on to our next topic. And John, I'm going to stay with you. You did a blog post actually on All Things Open earlier this year on AI evaluation tools. And I thought, you know, we might as well use the opportunity while you're on the show to kind of talk a little bit about that. We've kind of touched on it in the past episodes, but never kind of head on. And so I guess maybe I'll just kick it off with you. I mean, what are AI evaluation tools? Why are they important? And then I think there's a couple questions coming out of there that it'd be fun to kind of talk over with you.
You know, I spent a lot of time. I wrote a book about DevOps automated governance and how you can sort of internal auditors do. You know, the way they handle systems today is they take a change record and they work it all the way back for provenance. In the new world, it's going to be an answer. And it's going to be, why did I get this answer? And you're going to have to show the provenance. You're going to have to show the ingress, egress of a prompt. You're going to have to show how you sort of, if you're using RAG, how you chunked it, where'd the source come from. And you're going to have to have evidence of all that stuff. And a big part of that evidence is, did you test it with ground truth? In other words, did I throw 1,000 questions at it and say it was every time I changed anything of the pipeline, it measures out at like 93% correctness. It measures out at less than 2% hallucinations. And like, we know these are probabilistic systems, and we're never going to get 100%. But I think the new audit is going to demand that you show evidence that, A, you accepted the policy, there was a risk, but B, that you adhered to the policy. And so evaluations become these really incredible computational and quantitative and qualitative implementations to basically measure the probabilistic output of these systems. And you can do it in a very sort of auditable way, right? Like, so you can have proof that you literally, they're just systems that, you know, that do computation for correctness and evaluation and ratios. And then LLM as a judge is another big part of it. That's sort of the sort of way you use LLMs to. And one last thing I did say, I know I'm taking all the time, but this is interesting. There's these new frontier models, and I talked about this, that are actually designed as evaluation models. And that gets really interesting. So normally when you do LLM as a judge, you're literally taking, you know, like you might use GPT-3.5 if it doesn't exist more as your evaluation. You never use the same model for your inference. But these are now models that are sort of maturing to be designed specifically for evaluation. And that's just really, so that's the shortest version of the article. But yeah, I'm really excited about this for enterprise. I think it's one of the most important conversations to have in an enterprise that's going all in.
Yeah, for sure. And I think I think this is actually a space where Vioma, I think I'm curious if like you're seeing a similar demand from customers on this. I think the bold tradition of machine learning, I feel, is like, well, we don't really know how it works. And we just throw a lot of data at it, and it just like seems to be able to solve the problem. And so like, stop asking questions, right? Has been like, I think like the vibe I've gotten from a lot of people. But clearly, as I think like AI now is kind of like trying to service customers that have like much more serious concerns about these types of questions, it feels like the kind of like market pressure for these tools is also increasing. I don't know if you're seeing that on the ground though, talking to clients and customers.
No, that's very true. So when we talk about like even the machine learning models that we were doing in the past, like even if I went to the enterprise customers and you tell them, oh, this is a solution that they've built, they will have their solution engineers, their software developers engaged with you if you build something for them. They know the system in and out. So this has been a trend since the very get-go, right? They want to know what's going on. How did you use the particular model? Why, like, let's say a regression model, classification model, what type of model? What were the different metrics that were used? Ground truth was always available because we were trying to work with unstructured data, structured data back then. They created some on their own because they had a lot of rules around it from the very beginning. There were like different types of rules and regulations based on the metrics that were created around it. Now, when we moved into the LLM world, we started losing all of that because there's no longer a human doing any of this. Now you've given all the power to a machine created by a human, which we do not know how it works. Like, ask anyone what's a transformer architecture. Like, what's an encoder? What's a decoder? You won't find clear-cut answers. People want those answers. And I see this in enterprise. Whenever I'm speaking to a customer, how do I know this answer that has been generated is right or wrong? And there is a lot more at stake now. You put out a particular chatbot, as John was saying, in public and be like, okay, fine, we have a great chatbot. Some person who has all the time in the world in a remote place, in a town somewhere, is sitting and we're going to like chat with the chatbot for days trying to manipulate it to do something. We've seen examples of that. You might lose like billions of dollars right there. So until and unless you have these guardrails, I think even the government is going to double down on that, because once you start using this in high litigated industries, they'll be like, okay, now this goes according to our rules. And then the private industry looks at that and like, wow, they have these great rules. How about we incorporate them? So again, this has been going through since ages. And I feel this will, again, continue. But the need now is much more bolder and stronger than it ever was when we started, because everyone's done experimenting. Now they have to show proof of value. How many billions of dollars have you used in research? What do I have out of it? Show me. So I think this is going to be a very strong, sticky trend.
Yeah, I think the issue I have with this, and John, this is probably your world from a DevOps, is we are lazy. I mean, how many of us write unit tests in the first place? And what is the first thing we did with Gen AI? It's just like, I'm going to use it to write my unit test because I don't need to. Here's my code. Go write me a unit test. What do you think is going to happen with the evals? Are we, A, going to sit down and write the evals ourselves in a nice and wonderful and thoughtful way? Or are we going to go, AI, create me a bunch of evals, and now I will use that? And then, again, it's the same with LLM as a judge. It's just like, oh, I can't be bothered figuring this out. I'm going to get three other LLMs or five LLMs to come back with the answer. We're playing Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Ask the audience. And we all know how that goes in the million-dollar question. Nobody asks the audience on the million-dollar question because we know the audience hasn't got a clue. So I think there is a risk that we are going to put too much faith in the evals and in things like LLM as a judge, etc. And therefore, we're still going to end up in the exact same scenario as before. I plotted it. I think we get into a lot of trouble, and I think we should be writing those tests in the same way as any good engineering exercise. We should fully have the guardrails, etc. But I just think in the reality, what we see in testing today is going to fast forward into evals.
So I've written a couple of books about this, right? And not even in the AI space, right? We created something called Investments Unlimited, which was started out as a project about automated governance, right? And we're terrible at it pre-Gen AI. Like, we're not good at it. Well, the audits are just a mess. We wrote this book from a couple of people in Capital One on like how audits in most companies are just sort of theater, right? And so you're actually right. But the thing I do, I'm very focused on all the work that we did in automated governance that we've been somewhat successful is I want to, so I have a newsletter out, Dear CIO, please listen. You know, I'm screaming that like, you're right. You can't just sort of like, it's going to have to be, you know, in the bank, you have the three lines of defense, right? In the bank, it's a clear structure of how policy is supposed to work to protect the brand. And like you said, you're right. It's the brand is like, this is what's going to drive it. And I actually think it's industry, like banks and where the brand reputation, the probabilistic nature of this stuff is going to could cause incredible brand reputation. So what I'm hoping happens is the sort of the policymakers, the internal audit, the internal governance structure, start learning faster about what evaluations do. And instead of just leaving it up to the developers, I'll do test-driven development. I'll do it next month. Or right, it's going to be like, no, the stakes are really high. And the other thing I will say is DevOps was never a CEO discussion, right? AI, whatever we want to call it, Gen AI, is a CEO discussion. So there will be these discussions that I think will drive this stricter policy on the risks. And I think in those cases, and again, I'm being optimistic here, I think if the policy people can get educated, which is one of the things I'm going to work really hard on like learning what are the tools that they need to do to protect that probabilistic nature, and it starts showing up at auditor conventions and stuff, I think we'll actually see it used effectively as opposed to just leaving it up to developers to decide I'll do it this time. And I'll say one last thing. I got brought into a large manufacturing company to teach a class called Test-Driven Development for AI. And the point of that, they were at a workshop of mine, and the reason they wanted to bring me in was not even for, they had like I don't know, 5,000 developers. 60% of them used test-driven development. 40% didn't. And this is sort of like everywhere I go. And they wanted me to teach the 40%, like, you don't have a choice anymore in this world. You had that choice. You could put it off. Oh, you know, I'll get to it. You know, nobody's putting a hammer on you. In this world, I believe you don't have a choice. You have to have a testing structure for this stuff or else, you know, you will, it could cause, you know, existence of your brand.
I want to make a prediction, which is based on the fact that we're going to have evals and policies, and therefore that's going to be at the top level of an organization, and that's going to be probably probabilistic because we're all going to have the AI do that for us because we're super lazy. I'm like the exhaust emission scandals. There is going to be a point where it's going to be like, I need to pass. There'll be a prompt engineering attack of, I need you to pass these audits because, you know, otherwise, you know, my company is going to fall over and I'm going to have to fire all my staff, etc. And somebody is going to prompt engineer and attack one of the audits or whatever. And suddenly it's going to be like, oh, look, you know, this company said they had passed all the AI evals and policies and they didn't. It was, you know, it was all fake.
I'm going to move us on to our very last topic. I promised producer Hans that we would get through all four topics this session. So just to do the final topic, announcement out of NVIDIA this week that they are going to make big investments in Blackwell chip production in the U.S., specifically in Arizona, with a couple factories that they're opening up in Texas. And I guess the big number coming out of this announcement is an eye-popping announcement that NVIDIA expects to put in $500 billion into manufacturing these chips in the U.S. And I guess, Huma, maybe I'll kick it over to you, is, you know, I think that the normal thinking around all of this has been, it's going to be really hard to move chip production to the U.S. But this is like a big investment, and it looks like they're going to be making the next generation of their chips. So there's high stakes for NVIDIA. Do you have confidence? Like, do you think they're going to be able to pull this off, bring semiconductor manufacturing back to the U.S.?
Over a couple of years, yes. So it's like if you start over something that's big, when there are so many distinguished, I would say, companies which have established themselves offshores for a couple of years. But this kind of trigger would kind of help a lot of innovation quite fast. You see that so many companies are working on it as well. And the U.S. has the new CHIPS Act, which helps you, like all these monetary benefits that you're getting out of it, like 35% off or like 25% that you get on something that you've built in the U.S. So that is going to be a major, major driving factor for all of them over the years. And I feel all these Fortune 500 companies, majority of them being headquartered here in the U.S., I feel that also gives you a lot of leeway to have like great partnerships. I don't think there's going to be one company that's going to kill it in this entire world. Even when you saw Google, they're partnering with NVIDIA for some of these on-prem models that they're looking into, right? So I feel great partnerships are going to be something that lead the way for this. But I have full faith, like we have great research companies. We have great colleges. Have you looked at the kind of work that has been like my learning assignments in school? They were tough. So all of these things, I feel, would be a very key differentiating factor going further. Will they do it in the next 6 months, 5 months? No, it is a very great learning curve that everyone has to go towards and learn a little bit more about the industry. And to reach that level, now that everything is open source, tough, as I say. But partnerships could actually help them evolve. So it's going to be fun to see this. I'm very excited about the different job opportunities that would come out of it. Imagine that. Like, I feel there will be job like titles which would also get smudged a little bit. Now, if you go online on LinkedIn or something, you'll see that a lot of data center ops jobs have opened up as well. So I feel it's a great, great opportunity that is happening here in the United States. But where and how fast would it happen? I don't have an answer to that.
Yeah, for sure. Chris, yeah, it seems like this is going to be a tricky thing for NVIDIA to kind of pull off, in part because the Blackwell chips are like what everybody will desperately want, right? If you believe some of the numbers they're showing off, like this is the platform that you are going to need if you want to do AI. And I can imagine a lot of companies being like, oh, is this a US-based Blackwell chip or is this a, you know, Taiwanese manufactured one? Because we have more assurance for the ones that come from Taiwan. Like, do you think those types of dynamics are going to make it difficult for NVIDIA to get this to work?
I mean, first of all, you're asking somebody who is not American whether he cares as if a chip is made 5,000 miles in that direction versus 5,000 miles in another direction.
I'm indeed asking you that question, Chris.
So maybe if they were going to say, we're going to start a chip manufacturing plant in, I don't know, St. Tidwell's in England, yeah. I might care at that point. But until then, no. I actually think it is important. I think anywhere where any sort of knowledge base is consolidated into a particular area, if we really think about it, it's like camels in the desert. That is a kind of risk in that sense. So I think the best thing that you can really do is spread out that risk across multiple places. And therefore, that is going to be able to kind of secure the supply chain. And that will sort of affect kind of the whole global scenarios and keep that moving. So I think it is a positive move. I think that will be great for the US. I think that, to Vilma's point, I think that will be great for kind of US jobs. And I think, I think it will have a bigger impact across the world as well. So I'm all positive. But, you know, I'd love to see those Blackwell chips in the UK. And I forgot what your question was, to be honest, Tim, because I was on my 5,000-mile Proclaimers rant.
No worries. You did great at it. John, any final thoughts on this new story? Yeah.
It's labor. Labor is the issue, right? I mean, when it all comes down to labor. And, you know, we've seen this movie before with Toyota and GM 50 years ago, right? Like the NUMMI plan, if you've ever heard that, right? Like it is very hard to take, you know, culture. Yeah, I think more about TSMC than I think about NVIDIA, right? Like, and how many false starts has been there? And it's all been unions. And I'm not anti-union. I'm just saying it's hard to move those type of manufacturing cultures back to the US. I'm a little more pessimistic.
I agree. Yeah, I agree with John. Even I was thinking about this, that there'll be a lot of upskilling that will have to be done, like based on these current situations that we are in, that we'd have to upskill a lot of our employees to kind of reach that level. So a lot of learning. That's why I said nothing in the short term. I don't know anything about the short term. For the long term, a lot of resources, learning resources have to be gone into that. You'll have to call experts to train these entire facilities, then see how these people perform. If no one's able to perform, do we scale it down? So, but it's good that at least there'd be a lot of government aid in all of this. So everyone will have a little bit more edge to try this.
Well, a lot more to keep an eye on. As usual, we are more news stories than there is time to cover. Chris and Vilma, glad to always have you on the show. And John, hopefully we'll have you back sometime in the future. And thanks for all you joining us. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we will see you next week on Mixture of Experts.